This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Judge Jeffrey Ford of Champaign County says drugs, mental health, and other problem-solving courts can have great results, but they don't work all the time.
A lot of people don't want to. A lot of people are very comfortable in their addiction. They know they can do the time in the penitentiary, the time in the jail. They'll get out. They can just go back to using.
Judge Ford talks with Ryan Deneb about when not to place offenders in a problem-solving court. A teacher and local food producer lost his home in a fire and is thanking people for overwhelming public support. A climate change policy expert visiting the Twin Cities tells Mary Cullen about the economic hit Illinois will take from warming temperatures. Laura Kennedy reports on the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, a play about a boy with autism turned detective. And John Norton shares music and stories from the Smokers Blues Band. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Just a few years ago, it was rare for a county to have a problem-solving court, a separate track for high-risk, high-needs offenders most likely to get into trouble again and again. But problem-solving courts have spread, winning over skeptics by proving their value to the criminal justice system. McLean County has three such courts: drug court, recovery court for those with serious mental illness, and a new one for veterans. Around 600 judges, lawyers, law enforcement officers, and mental health and substance abuse treatment professionals met last week in Normal. GLT's Ryan Denham was there and spoke to Judge Jeffrey Ford, the president of the Illinois Association of Problem-Solving Courts, about the future of this approach to criminal justice and behavior modification.
I have a guy right now who used to be basically a gangbanger who is now working at Burger King and loving it. And he gets, you know, insults from all the old people that used to be around, but he's realized life is so much better this way. And you can't imagine when he first gets a job working at Burger King how excited he was. And I have a lot of people like that. We've had graduates now who are, I have them working all over in Champaign-Urbana. They have moved up their managers in different places. They've started their own businesses and doing well. And these are people who really never worked much in their life. Mm-hmm. So instead of taking away from the tax base, they're adding to it. Families are staying together. DCFS isn't getting called. There's less police reports on these people. And I'd had people who'd been to the penitentiary numerous times, kept them out of the penitentiary, kept them in their home, and just now they're thriving.
To a layman like me, it seems that problem-solving courts are a relatively new thing for the state of Illinois, but is it actually true? How long have they been around in this type of format?
I didn't realize, but in 1991, I took over traffic court in Champaign County, and I changed the way we did DUIs, and it wasn't for another 10 years before the research came out on drug courts that I was really running a drug court for DUIs, which is now called a DUI court. And the first drug court was in 1989 in Miami, and then they've kind of gone from there. But they're in all 50 states. They're in countries all over the world now. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, mental health courts and mental health courts came on after that.
So in McLean County here at Bloomington-Normal, we have, a drug court, a recovery court for those with serious mental illness, and most recently added a veterans court. So where does that put us in terms of other counties around the state? Is it pretty common to have that kind of mix, or are we an outlier in some way?
No, you're not an outlier. In a mental health court, you don't get as many people as you would in a drug court. Veterans courts are harder just because, again, there are veterans out there, but not everybody qualifies, and some don't want it. Some counties can establish them. In Champaign County, we basically have a track in our drug court for veterans, where when I have a veteran, I call the VA. We're working on a mentorship program for mentors for them, so this would be a special thing. But no, most counties that have the financial ability to do so will have drug court and try and have a mental health court and veterans court also.
And you mentioned financial ability. So what are some of the limits of problem-solving courts? Is there, beyond, you know, the limit to the volume of cases you can take on, do you find that there are limits that the public should know about?
Well, one of the limits we need is that we need a certain population. We're wasting money if we don't have medium to high risk, high needs. Because, again, the research has shown they can do just as well on regular probation. And we can't mix those populations. If we put a high-risk person in with a low-needs person, what we're going to do is make that low-needs person is going to become a better criminal because we mix them together. So we can't mix the population. The problem that we're starting to have is that some politicians or other look at this and say, well, we should just open this up to everybody, and then you're just going to dilute the monetary value that we're, the savings that we're having, and the effectiveness of it, because we're going to end up mixing populations too. So if we stay with the distinct populations that the research says we get the best results from, that's where we should be. Now, again, they're voluntary, so a lot of people don't want to. A lot of people are very comfortable in their addiction. They know they can do the time in the penitentiary, the time in the jail. They'll get out. They can just go back to using. Again, addiction never really goes away. A lot of what we teach in the drug court is how to handle situations. First, how to change people, places, and things to keep you away from those situations. But this is life. You're going to end up in a situation like that. How do you handle it so you don't relapse? Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult because the brain doesn't forget these things, and they don't forget the drugs.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Judge Jeff Ford from Champaign County, who's president of the Illinois Association of Problem-Solving Courts. It's hosting its sixth annual conference at the Bloomington Normal Marriott this week with around 600 attendees. So, Judge Ford, you've got at least one session at this conference on medical marijuana. So what are some of the unique challenges that the medical marijuana's growth can cause for problem-solving courts?
Let's start with the beginning. Most of the people who use started out with either alcohol or cannabis or both. If we get them back with the situation, we're trying to keep them clean, and all of a sudden they smell that familiar smell. They see the acts that everybody else is doing that got them in trouble. They're going to regress. It's hard, people, places, and things, if you're walking down the street and you start smelling that smell again. So it's going to be a very difficult situation for our people. And you have a lot of people, when I was doing DUIs, I'd get somebody who was 20 and say, well, you know, I'll be able to drink when I'm 21, and I'll look at their reports on their substance abuse problems and say, no, you really shouldn't. Well, it's legal. That doesn't matter, because this is going to take you down for the rest of your life unless you change. And it's the same thing with cannabis. One of the problems with cannabis is it's harder to detect than a breathalyzer test. So the technology has not caught up to that, but the research from Colorado and Washington and places where it's legal is traffic collisions are up there just because of that in and of itself. Cannabis presents its own special problems, but if somebody thinks it's not addictive, no, it can be very addictive. There is higher and higher potencies, and it's now we have edibles, we have oils, and depending upon the THC content or what it's mixed with, because they will mix other drugs in the cannabis, it can be very dangerous, especially to the population that's in a drug court or a mental health court or even a veterans court.
So we've got drug courts, mental health recovery courts, veterans courts. There are DUI courts. So are there other categories of problem-solving courts that are emerging that you've seen in counties around the state that could spread to other places?
There are some. The one interesting one where it was kind of a oh moment for me was when Cook County started a prostitution court. But then I started thinking about it and thought, that makes a whole lot of sense. You have a specific population with a specific problem. Most of the people in that court, of course, are female. A lot of this would have been traumatic for them, how they got in and their addiction problems. So there's a lot of similarities. Why not separate them out and have their own court? There's a movement, and there's what's called, there's juvenile drug courts too, which poses different problems than a regular adult drug court, but they're catching on. It's much more expensive, because when you have a juvenile, you feel like a hypocrite as a judge where the problem's at home and you have to send them back at home because it's a delinquency matter and not an abuse neglect matter, and then they're back in that same environment. So if the problem is at home and if the parents are using but they haven't committed a crime yet, we may end up having to treat 3, 4, 5 people instead of one that we would in a drug court. There are family recovery courts now, which are more like our abuse neglect courts. in the state of Illinois, but they geared more towards some of the drug court, mental health court principles. Although in Illinois, when you talk about a juvenile, whether it's abuse, neglect, or delinquency, since the late 1800s, Illinois has treated juveniles differently. We were one of the first states. And so the judge has always been allowed to do more in those courts than they were in a criminal court or anything else. So for a family court or juvenile drug court, it's much more moving in the way that Illinois has been moving for over 100 years now.
So as you look to the next 5 to 10 years, what are going to be some of the challenges, some of the opportunities, and some of the biggest issues that face the problem-solving court community in Illinois?
The way we run, of course, is we need the ability, the financial resources to be able to go forward. Almost every court, not all of them, started with hundreds of thousands of dollars of grant money. And some continue to run because they continue to get grants, but eventually they have to become self-supporting. The communities really have to step up and help. These courts, if done correctly, save millions for every county that they're operating in. Because, as I said before, less crime, people staying there, working, keeping families together, so DCFS is left out, the police are left out, businesses don't have as much damage just to pay for, insurance companies don't have as much. I mean, there's huge savings, not just talking about days in the penitentiary. There's less days in the penitentiary because these people aren't going, but they're staying at home and they're starting to thrive and pay taxes. So the communities are getting a benefit, but we need the communities to really to step up and start paying for some of these things and taking over for the grants. Other problem is we don't know what drugs are coming down the line. You've heard about synthetics. There's synthetic cannabis. There's synthetic cocaine that's out there. And of course, the medical community is hard-pressed to react because somebody says, oh, I was just smoking, you know, cannabis or marijuana. And no, they weren't, but they didn't know. And, of course, their body, their pulse, their blood pressure, everything else is not acting like they were taking marijuana, and they can't tell them what was in that. The synthetic opioids or synthetic cocaine, I'm sorry, there's the reaction to some of that is almost a psychotic reaction, where people would end up in a locked psych ward, really not needing it, but they've got so many psychotic features, they have to wait until this drug passes or even months after that to make a determination if this person really has a psychosis problem or if it's all from the synthetic drug they took. And there's new synthetic drugs coming out all the time. They're harder to test for, because the drug companies don't make tests for them unless they become illegal, because then it's not profitable to, so it's hard to test for. So these are some of the problems that are going to be with us for a while.
Champaign County Judge Jeffrey Ford says another recent development in problem-solving courts is that individual counties now have to prove they're meeting the Illinois Supreme Court's standards for how these courts should work. Judge Ford is head of the Illinois Association of Problem-Solving Courts, which drew 600 people to Normal for its conference. He spoke with GLT's Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating local philanthropy on November 15th with a workshop for nonprofits and a luncheon honoring Dwayne and Tony Farrington, the 2018 Philanthropists of the Year. Details at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a drastic fire leaves a local teacher and farm producer homeless, and the community responds. Eric Stock has more. The United Nations recently released its annual climate report. It shows the world at risk from climate change if drastic changes in human behavior are not made before 2040. University of Chicago Assistant Professor of Public Policy Amir Gina studies how climate change impacts economics around the world. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Gina about climate change in the UN report ahead of his presentation Thursday at Illinois Wesleyan University. Gina says the consequences for Illinois will be profound.
Illinois is very dependent on agriculture, or rather there's a large contribution to agriculture in the U.S. coming from these parts of the Midwest. We will see, as you expect, that some of those crops are going to be exposed to more frequently high temperatures, and that there'll be some losses involved with that. We'll start to see some effects on mortality and illnesses happening around the state as we experience more frequent hot days. But there's also some benefits. The cold winter days are also responsible for a lot of excess mortality. And so as we experience fewer of those, there will be a decrease of those cold-related deaths. But it seems like in the results that we're seeing that there might be an excess of the heat-related deaths and that the offset from the fewer cold-related deaths doesn't quite account for an overall benefit.
So a study that I actually found recently is from a Northern Illinois University study. He found that the pattern of tornadoes in the U.S. is shifting eastward away from states like Kansas and deeper into Illinois, Indiana, and beyond. So the eastern impacted states have more of a dense population than the previously affected western states. What exactly does that mean for the economic impact? And is there a tie between these tornadoes and the change in climate?
So there's definitely a relationship between the tornadoes and the climate. That's not something that we've looked at specifically. But beyond just thinking of temperature changes, there's many other types of changes to tornadoes or hurricanes. Of course, hurricanes not affecting Illinois. More intense rainfall being one of them, where we see some changes. The truth about those is that the economic damages that are due to these different changes and effects are not as well understood as you would think. For a tornado, for example, we can look up kind of the accounting details and the insurance details of what this cost. But the implications for some other research, particularly ones looking at other types of natural disasters like floods and hurricanes, suggest that in addition to that, there may be larger hidden costs. In particular, I'm thinking of one study by a co-author which shows that 10 years after a hurricane hits, that those costs are actually 10 times larger than the initial damages. So as we think about hurricanes shifting into more populated places, there is this idea that potentially we might be missing some of those costs by just looking at adding up the damages or the insurance claims, that there's also these different changes that happen to the population, and particularly to more vulnerable members of the population.
So we're starting to see people, it seems like they're noticing a drop in temperature or a rapid increase in temperature. They're seeing these reports from the UN about climate change. Would you say this is the start of society caring more about climate change?
I would hope so, but then I think every year we see more, in particular, see very large natural disasters happening in different places in the world, and it's still very hard to motivate political or public action. At some point, I would hope there will be a threshold which is crossed where we start to realize that we can't not do anything, and particularly after the last year, 2017 and 2018 were very bad years for large natural disasters. Of course, they happened in other parts further away from our part of the country here. But in terms of the federal assistance money that needs to go to constantly bail out places, this is adding to a drag on the national economy. And so this is something which, even if we might not notice it, is being felt in the pockets of people around Illinois. And I think repeated exposure to those types of events and increasingly seeing people connect those to climate change, because there is some component of it which is made worse by climate change, is starting to make people think, actually, this is not just an abstract problem in a far-off country or in a far-off time. This is something that we're actually experiencing now. So I do see the change, but when that starts to translate into the political action that it needs to deal with the overall problem is, I think, anyone's guess.
So you personally, you also studied the impact of climate control on developed versus developing countries. Who would you say bears the largest cost of climate change?
So far, we suspect that some of the largest costs are through damages to people's health. Of course, it's difficult to think about the damages here when you're comparing very rich and very poor countries, because there can be some kind of losses which look small in dollar terms. So we could see some small loss of agricultural productivity in a poor country. But because there's so many people who are dependent on agriculture for the food that they're eating directly from their own fields, that small loss might be 50-60% of their annual income. So even though it's small in dollar terms, it might be extremely large in terms of the income that they have. That's one of the main differences that we see across wealthier and poorer countries. In addition to seeing that there's, you know, maybe smaller dollar losses in poorer countries, but it might be more consequential to people, I think what we need to do in terms of policy is think about things that are appropriate for the country setting. So instead of saying air conditioning is the way to go for these people who are making very little money in India or sub-Saharan Africa, to try and think of the appropriate policy response there to the experiences they're facing.
Is it too late to lessen the impact of climate change, or are there things that still can be done?
That's a very good and very interesting question, and something that we are all thinking about here, both on the policy side and the research side, and hopefully people in the public are thinking about that too. The report that came out, there was some quite emphatic headlines stating that we have 10 years or 12 years to try and reduce the effects of climate change. There's some truth to that, but I think the real story is a bit more complicated. I think at any point, we have the ability to do something about climate change. What happens the longer we wait is doing something about it becomes more expensive. But I think if we're thinking like rational policymakers, we should be thinking of what gives us the biggest bang for our buck. And the biggest bang for our buck here is to be able to enact the policies and pay the lower costs now rather than wait until we face the larger costs in the future.
Amir Gina's presentation at Illinois Wesleyan University is part of the university's Changing Climates series. The event is 7 p.m. Thursday night, and it's free and open to the public. Gina spoke with GLT's Mary Cullen.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, a collaboration between Advocate Broman and OSF St. Joseph Medical Centers, providing cancer care, education, and prevention services at 407 East Vernon in Normal. One hope, one mission, one community. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The phrase, what was the curious thing the dog did in the nighttime? The dog did nothing in the nighttime. That was a curious thing. Has been with us since Sherlock Holmes and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Laura Kennedy has more in just a moment on a dramatic take on that. It was only a matter of days before Deering County Farms was back in operation and owner Brad Deering was back teaching at U-High after an overnight fire destroyed the home he built for his family in rural Danvers nearly 15 years ago. Deering took time during the long, arduous cleanup to talk to GLT's Eric Stock about how his farm and church families and the community at large have stepped in to help.
It was 2 a.m. and I heard, I was awoke by a sound of what sounded like hail. Hail, like, kind of popped up, and I thought, man, we're not supposed to get a storm, and sure enough, as I awoke, I saw, like, light, and I went to the window there, and I saw that there was flames outside there, outside the window, and yelled, fire, fire, and Jackie got up and grabbed the baby and ran and grabbed the other kids and ran outside, and we all ran down and got out. That's really in the nutshell what happened, and I ended up, had to run back in before it wasn't engulfed or anything, but I ran back in quickly to grab a cell phone. We didn't even have a cell phone as we ran out, and then dialed 911 and just waited at that point.
Jackie, your wife, and three kids?
Yes, three kids.
From what I recall, the fire went on for hours before they were able to get it all out.
Right, yeah. I mean, we're rural, and it was a volunteer fire department. It does take time for the response, and we know that. And it was fully going by the time they had gotten here. And once they got here and got set up, they were able to direct some water to, like, a car that was in the front and help, maintain as much of that as possible, and had a farmer's market trailer on the north side there, and they were able to kind of save that. And so we had some freezers in there with food, that we sell at market. And then my old Camaro, I had an old car on that side too that they were able to keep wet and keep cold so it didn't damage it in any way. But at that point, the house was fully engulfed, and they're worried about protecting it from spreading at that point. So.
Now, what about the farm itself?
The farm's fine. The fire was just concentrated here at the home. All the barns, livestock, and everything are well within, 100 yards away from the house or so. So none of that was in danger.
So what was that like for the day after, putting all the pieces together and trying to figure out how to get everything back to normal?
Tough. I mean, you're in shock for days and some week after it happens, and just have to, you know, look at your needs and what do I need to do right now? And, you know, you just had to get basic supplies, and we got checked into a hotel here in town, and, you know, then the phone calls and the emails, and the one phone that we had was our home cell phone. And so, you know, we were able to log on to Facebook and social media, and people were reaching out to us. And but then our also the need was back to the livestock. We still had to keep water and electric out for livestock, but all that was located in the home, the headquarters, if you will. And so I spent the next several days just getting temporary water established and electric going. And so, yeah, that and coupled with maintaining the family and maintaining their needs.
What about your community, your neighbors, the farming community that help you get back up and running again? Because, as you said, the need for power and water right away.
Right. Yeah, we had the Browns that came, friends of ours that we had, you know, known since the farmers market, and neighbors down the road, and they helped us haul water those first few days before power was reestablished to get, you know, keep water on the livestock. So yeah, again, big shout out to them. And then, like I said, the farmers market community organizing aid for us. And, you know, that's just been overwhelming to receive, you know, that outreach from the whole community as well. I mean, we start to see all the families extended from your own. Like, I teach at U-High and ISU and the Metcalf where our kids are and our church. And, you know, just you see all those families that you've become one with, I guess, in the community, and like I said, the farmers market community. And it's overwhelming and a very humbling to experience all that. That's, you know, humbling is the best word.
And to continue to do everything that you have to do. You still have to go back to school to teach with your wife, continuing to run the family farm, run the business. You're raising three kids, and you still have to plow ahead.
Right, and that's our mantra, really. And I say that on a daily basis anymore, because people ask how you're doing and, you know, what the experience, and, you know, just keep going and look forward. And every day, I say this kind of a little testimony, I guess, but every day we wake up, you have a choice to make, whether you're going to be positive for the day or, you know, go into a negative mode. And
this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Brad Deering from Deering Country Farms, family rebuilding after losing their home to a fire last month. You have said that your church, Eastview Christian in Normal, has also helped in the effort.
Well, they've organized through their youth ministry. Our kids both go there, and as well as us, but they're at the youth ministry, and they've organized groups of people to kind of come out today and help organize, go through all of our, you know, the debris, and we're still looking for some keepsakes and separating out the metal and the wood for disposal purposes as well, but mainly looking for the keepsakes, things that we're going to remember, because it was a total loss. I mean, we're finding little fragments of things here and there, but even those little mementos or little stack of pictures, even if it's partial, it's still something that reminds you of your past.
Anything that you recall that you have been able to recover that sort of has that value? I mean, you mentioned the, you know, the antique car, of course, and your cell phone, but anything that has a sentimental value?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, fragments of pictures, like I'd mentioned, and you can still make out the pictures. And we did find a bowling ball. It's a family. It's my wife's grandpa's old bowling ball. It had his name on it, and it survived. And we had several others, but those didn't survive. So it's kind of an interesting thing that made it. And again, you know, small pieces of clothing or something that kids have taken pictures in, or, you know, we'll find a piece of that here and there. But you know, it is all stuff, and that's the thing that we're taking away from this too, is everybody's fine. And you know, we're moving forward, and, you know, family, friends, and faith. And, you know, those are the keys. And, you know, move forward with that and don't dwell on all the things that we've lost, because they are just things. Mm-hmm. But it you know, it kind of defines who you are in a lot of ways as well. But we just are starting over. And, you know, like I said, the three F's, you know, is important.
The house you built yourself.
Yep, back in 2003-04. We built the home out here and bought the land, and the plan currently is to rebuild. We're still, you know, in the cleanup phase to determine, you know, the site where we might build back here on the land. But yeah, that's the plan, is to rebuild. And like I said, the livestock and everything is still here, So it's just a matter of designing and building a new home.
So people come to you, they know what happened, they know the story, and they say, what do you need? How can we help?
Yeah, it's interesting, because not everybody knows, and so sometimes, you know, people come up and, you know, give you the condolences, and we're sorry what happened, and then other people, just like a normal Saturday, hey, how are you today? And, you know, even though you may be struggling, you know, emotionally or physically or whatever, you still try to put the smile, you know, forward, and then, you know, you say, hey, did you hear? And then obviously, you know, people are, oh my gosh, I didn't know. And so it puts it into perspective that you don't know what somebody's going through. And I've said that before many times in past experiences of losing loved ones or whatever. You don't know what the person you're interacting with is going through in their lives. And so, you know, the message there, I think, is just to be nice. Be nice, just in general. And because you don't know. And somebody could be rude to you or mean to you or something, but you don't know what they're going through. And so, you know, be nice is important. But, yeah, as far as what we need, I mean, our needs are met. And you start to realize how little we actually need to survive in life. But, you know, you get the other wants, but, you know, you decide what you need. And our needs are being currently met. And now it's just rebuilding our lives and moving forward, like we said.
The Deerings are now living in a rental home after the Red Cross put them in a hotel temporarily. A GoFundMe page has raised close to $22,000 to help the family get back on its feet. The Bloomington Farmers Market is accepting gift cards to nearly a dozen stores for the Deering family. Investigators say they don't know what caused the fire. GLT's Eric Stock talked with Brad Deering. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Wellington the dog is dead, and Christopher Boone is on the case to find the killer. This begins The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, an award-winning book that became an award-winning play that is opening October 26th at the Illinois State University Center for the Performing Arts. The play offers a poignant and genuine look into the emotional workings of a unique teenager who describes himself as a mathematician with some behavioral difficulties. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Christopher is a teenager with an extraordinary brain, and the play, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, allows the audience inside as Christopher embarks on a great adventure, discovering some disconcerting truths along the way. The play is directed by Kristen L. Schoenbeck, and like many, she was enthralled by the book by Mark Haddon, upon which the play by Simon Stevens was based. She eagerly read it at the age of 13.
For me, it was this book about differences and how the world is full of people who are different than us and how we sort of tend to ostracize them and sort of find other people, quote, like us. And I think that's because of fear. And so for me, the reason I wanted to direct this play is to be able to give our audience a little taste of Christopher and his world and to hopefully encourage people to look beyond those fears to create a sort of less lonely or divisive world.
What do we learn when we see through Christopher's eyes in this play?
That Christopher sees things in such a beautiful, special, and unique way. And while it is different, it is not bad or wrong. And so when we get to watch Christopher, we're sort of let into his world. We empathize with him. We sort of want to root him on in the things that he's doing. And so the idea that we're seeing him as a human being and not as him put in this box that we label him, possibly, I think that's one thing that's really interesting is neither Simon Stevens nor Mark Haddon diagnose Christopher.
So they don't say he's on the spectrum and here's where he's at.
We do see a lot of behaviors and the way he sort of talks about himself in both the novel and the play lends itself to that. But I think what's really interesting is we as a reader or an audience go, oh, well, I'm putting him in that box. And then we have to face the fact that we just did that and wrestle with that during the play.
A lot of books, a lot of movies, a lot of things are being translated for the stage these days. So let's talk about how well the book translates to the stage, because there's a lot, just like you, there's a lot of fans of the book out there.
The book is told from Christopher's point of view. It's sort of like journal entries. And so Simon Stevens, it's really interesting. In interviews with him, he would say, well, I wasn't worried about translating the story itself. I was worried about how does Christopher get from Swindon to London and how do we showcase that?
And so on a stage.
On the stage, yeah. And so I think that's been the biggest challenge when anybody faces it, let alone our particular company has faced. How do we show everything that Christopher describes, because he's so specific in certain things. And so my team and I have sort of, when we were reading the play over and over again, we wanted to create a space that was Christopher's world. He's unable to necessarily showcase his emotions as clearly as other people, and so we wanted to create a space where he could sort of give over to that a little bit more. So it's highly physical. We've got a giant ensemble that sort of helps Christopher build and construct the things he's describing. And when Christopher sort of runs into things that might make him feel uncomfortable or sad or angry, and he's not necessarily able to showcase that, we have an entire ensemble there to sort of help elevate that emotion and give it over to the audience.
So we're learning about the inner workings of Christopher and his mm-hmm. world and how he moves around in that world. Does this at all overshadow the detective work, the mystery?
Oh, not at all. It's really interesting because, again, the play kickstarts with a neighbor's dog,
Wellington,
being murdered in this brutal way with a garden fork. And Christopher logically says, well, I need to find out who killed this dog.
And he does it sort of Sherlock Holmesian, mm-hmm. you know.
It's he's so fascinated by that because...
Because of Holmes's brain.
Mm-hmm. Again, those things are very logical, and logic makes sense to Christopher. Ritual and repetition makes sense to him, whereas sort of like emotions and metaphors make no sense. The investigation kicks off, but it's really interesting because that investigation turns into something a lot bigger and bolder. He's faced with bigger problems than he's ever faced before. And how does he sort of go through that, especially when it deals with big human emotions? How does he face that and learn how to live in a world that isn't something he necessarily sees like everybody else?
Tell me about the actor you have playing Christopher.
Oh, yes. His name is Derek Ray. I believe he's a sophomore. I've been blessed with my entire team of actors. They jumped very boldly into the pool. I have asked a lot of them. It's not only highly demanding physically, but it's a play that's very highly demanding emotionally. Like I said, we deal with big things in this play.
And they're young people that maybe didn't have to wrestle with such things as they were growing up. So
yes.
That's asking a lot.
Yeah, and especially approaching the character of Christopher, it was really important to us that we didn't play into a label, play into an assumption of a label. Especially since, again, he wasn't diagnosed in the play, all we get to see are particular behaviors and why he has those behaviors. And like I said, Mark Haddon's novel and the play so beautifully gives us all the tools that we need. And so we just looked at, Derek and I spent some time looking at what were things that he didn't like and why he didn't like them. When it comes to moments that we so generally label a sensory overload, what exactly is that overload and how does he overcome that? And what tools does Christopher have to use that? And so we focused just on the tangible text to get us there. Because again, it's important for us to see not a washed out label of someone on the spectrum, but for us to leap into the mind of someone of such a beautiful mind of a teenager who may be a little bit different. When we meet people like Christopher, how do we view them right away, right? Do we view them as an intrusion or an interruption in our lives? How do we respond to them? And sort of we see people practicing empathy, or we see places where empathy is not practiced, and we sort of catch that. And I'm hoping that it brings sort of questions up in our own lives as we see that.
You have a special performance, a sensory-friendly performance. Tell me about this.
I am very excited about this. Bloomington Normal has a very large community of children and adults on the spectrum, and we've teamed up with Autism McLean, and I've been talking with some people in their department and on their board to create a special sensory-friendly performance. And so what this is the play is the same, but we just want to create a space that is a little bit more freeing, that doesn't have the rules and regulations of audience goers, for people to enjoy this story and experience Christopher's world as well.
So do you think this is a good play for parents of children who may be on the spectrum or who may exhibit personality traits like Christopher to come see this show and maybe find it heartening to see this character and what he goes through?
Absolutely. Not only for kids to see Christopher go through all of this stuff, but for parents to see Christopher's parents sort of go through the trials and tribulations of raising a child and the conclusion they come to at the end. I mean, the play is ultimately deals with family at its core, Christopher and his father and his mother, and how he can work through that. And also how Christopher can grow up, right? He's a 15-year-old boy, and how does he live and survive beyond family? It's very relatable, but it's full of a lot of love. And so I'm very excited to share it.
That's Kristen L. Schoenbeck, director of A Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The show opens October 26th and runs through November 3rd at the Illinois State University Center for Performing Arts. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The sensory-friendly performance of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is at 2 p.m. October 28th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Peoria's The Smokers Blues Band hopes its blues rock music can be part of a broader scene, helping unite deep political divisions among Central Illinois music fans. The band will be sporting a brand new album when it returns to Jazz Up Front in Bloomington Saturday night. Band members Dan Galletti and Brett David stopped by the GLT studios to talk about The Smokers' sophomore release, which Galletti says is a departure from their three-year-old debut album.
The first album was more eclectic. I mean, we were just going for whatever we had, you know, just threw it on the wall and let's see what sticks.
Yeah, I think that's a good...
This was more focused. We had an idea of what we wanted to do, a little bit more conceptual.
Okay, there was a jam bandy song or two even on that debut album.
Correct. Yeah, it was. It was a little more that open kind of format, and these songs were more concise.
Okay, well, let's go to the title track, Coming to Your Town. Wrote this song, Dan.
Yes.
What I heard in it, it's a plea to be good to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it just started off as a lick, and it sat around for months, and I didn't have anything for it. I didn't have an idea for it, but I liked the riff. Given the political climate that we live in, and I just thought, well, what can we do as a band to just make a simple statement, not really political in either direction, but just keep it very simple? And it was kind of a throwback to the 60s. It made me think of that era in that time. And that's something that Brett and I have always enjoyed, that era of music. So that's really what it is. It's a protest blues song throwback. Why don't you stop?
Brett, I'll go to you on that same thought then. Are people starting to recognize that we got to tone it down a little bit?
That's a tough question. I don't know that people recognize what needs to be done so much as everyone seems to be in agreement that something needs to be done, because, you know, it's very similar, I think, to, you know, what we've seen in newsreels and the history that we've seen from that. It seems like there's a lot of that same
dynamic repeating itself.
Yeah.
How do we get out of this?
That's a good question. Music is usually good for that sort of thing. It seems to people sometimes will take a moment and stop what they're doing just to listen to what's going on with the music. And so hopefully, if anything comes out of this album, it would be kind of nice that people were a little nicer to each other, spend a little more time working on making the world a better place instead of just going with the flow and saying something needs to be done, but not offering any idea as to what could be done to make it better.
Let's go to another song that I think is a little bit more bitter now. It's called Drinking for Two. Brett, this is the song you wrote.
Well, Dan and I both wrote it.
Oh, you both wrote it. Okay.
Yep.
It had a... Let me play just a little bit of it here.
Okay.
musically, it kind of has a kind of a southern rock feel to it.
Yeah, I don't know that that's where it started. It kind of was more of a Keith Richards-y kind of start to the song. Dan and I had talked about, like, how can we make our music something that's a little bit different from everybody else that goes out and tries to do the traditional blues or blues rock. And one of the things that we felt would improve, you know, our music and kind of, again, harkens back to that 60s music is having more harmonies, more multiple vocals versus just one guy singing all the time. So we were looking for something that we could do that with, and I sent him the first verse and
It was a Lennon-McCartney thing that we've been doing since we were 18 or 17 when we first met each other and came together as songwriters.
So. Oh, interesting. Our guests are Dan Galletti and Brett David with the band The Smokers Blues Band out of Peoria. They're playing jazz up front on Saturday night. I'm not hearing a lot of blues rock in central Illinois, at least in Bloomington Normal, as much as I used to anyway. Is blues still a thing in Peoria?
It is. I mean, there had been a blues fest that was very traditional.
But blues. Even that's gone to blues and heritage.
It's
now.
Diversified. Yeah. Now. Yeah. And that's not such a bad thing. I think blues is one of those things where it's always had a following, but it's never really been mainstream or commercial. You know, Stevie Ray Vaughan and the Kings, they added to the commercialism blues. But for the most part, it's been more of a roots-based genre. And I think what Peoria's tried to do with that particular festival is tried to open the doors a little bit and open the channels. So that way, if you can pull a wider audience in with other music that's maybe somewhat related to blues, maybe there's some crossover, that they'll get that exposure to true blues or traditional blues, and then you'll develop that fan base even further. So I think maybe that's the idea.
Well, let me ask it this way. There seems to be more of an audience still for the blues rock, you know, blues-based music, but this seems to be more of a singer-songwriter town in Bloomington Normal, where there's still more of an edgier to the music in Peoria. Would I be somewhat accurate in saying that?
I would say that the Peoria has always been this classic rock kind of, you know, market for the most part, and Bloomington being more college-driven, I could see that being the case, mm-hmm. You know, the singer-songwriter thing. And so that's probably, I mean, I would say that's probably a fair statement.
Traveling Salesman is another song I want to get to on the album. Coming to Your Town is the name of it. It's from the Smokers Blues Band, Dan Galletti and Brett David from the band in our JLT studios. Well, I really love this. I love when the B3 comes in on it. I love the jamming on it. It kind of has a Black Crowes feel to it.
Well, it's funny you should mention that because we opened up for Steve Gorman, who's the drummer of the Black Crowes.
Oh, yeah, right, when you started that charity.
And that was that charity. Yep, that we did to benefit MSA. Good friend of ours, Larry Kellerman, was behind that. Mm-hmm. He's been putting one together every year since, and there'll be another one for next year, too. And I think Steve Gorman might be involved in it again. Other than that, I can't think of any other influence specifically from the Black Crowes. But, I mean, that was our time in high school, for sure.
The Black Crowes.
Like Brett mentioned, I mean, we didn't grow up in the 60s together, but we admired that music. And when we were in high school, you know, when we first met and we were writing songs, then it was the early 90s, and you had this departure from the synth wave of the 80s, and thank goodness for that. Yeah. You know, and you had bands like the Black Crowes that were breaking it all down again and putting blues rock back out there, and that was influential to us, absolutely.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton, Dan Galletti, and Brett David with the Smokers Blues Band in studio. You were up at Buddy Guy's a few years ago, and you were telling me that it was a cool story about being on stage at Legends,
yeah,
with
yeah.
Buddy Guy.
Yeah, we had twice. We were up there, and Buddy was there. He was there both times, and we were lucky to have him come up on stage with us, which I guess isn't very common, but we were told by the staff. But he came up on stage with us both times. It's funny because one of the songs that we do on our show, it's called The Rumor, is one of the songs that Buddy came up, and he kind of tapped us on the shoulder and he interrupted it because he liked the song so much, and he wanted to just start ad-libbing to the song. Now, when we do the show, this song, The Rumor, in our show, Brett, who wrote the song, basically ad-libs Buddy Guy during the song. It's kind of a break and an instrumental point of the song, and Brett recreates that night by ad-libbing Buddy Guy. And it's funny, because so we call the song The Ballad of Buddy Guy, too.
He actually said to an audience, I don't know why, he's lived in Chicago for 50 years. He doesn't know that it's Illinois. But he says, hey, come on,
basically, he came up behind me, just kind of tapped me on the shoulder, and I thought it was another guy in the band. So I turned around like, what do you need? And I'm just staring right in the face of, you know, a blues legend. It wasn't about him as much as it was about bringing attention to us.
Hmm.
Like, you know, he's on stage all the time. Everybody knows who he is. But when he went up on stage, he was addressing the audience and telling them about us. And pointing out that there was a tip jar that they needed to come and fill for us. You know, it was just
a very kind thing,
very
to do.
Very humbling, yeah, experience to see somebody in that lofty position, you know, in the music world.
But yeah, just to think about it, this man arguably is the greatest now living blues legend.
I don't think it's even
world.
Arguably. I think,
yeah,
it is.
I mean, after B.B. King, right. he's what's left. And
well, he remembers. He grew up dirt poor in Louisiana,
yeah,
so I'm sure,
yeah,
he remembers that all the time.
Oh, absolutely. Huh. And you know, and his you know, his venue, arguably the greatest blues pub in the world. So I mean, we're here. We're at the apex. It's all been downhill from there for us, you know.
You should have just quit right there. It's
not, right? Dan Galletti and Brett David of Peoria's The Smokers Blues Band speaking with GLT's John Norton. The band returns to Jazz Up Front in Bloomington Saturday night. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Ryan Denham, Mary Cullen, and John Norton. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.